Welcome to Out the Gate, a new podcast about sailing on and around San Francisco Bay. I'm Ben Shaw. In this episode, we're going to talk about sailing, but we're also talking sharks. I sat down with David McGuire at the Dolphin Club, a swimming and rowing club on Aquatic Park here in San Francisco. David, who had just come out of the water from an evening swim, is a sailing captain, a dive master, a filmmaker, and protector of the ocean, in particular sharks. I'll let him introduce himself.
My name is David McGuire. I'm the director and founder of Shark Stewards. We're a nonprofit part of the Earth Island Institute based in Berkeley. We're a local, national, and international advocacy group for shark and ocean protection.
Tell me about how you initially got into your work protecting sharks. I understand it was tied to sailing.
Definitely tied with sailing. I grew up as a middle-class kid in Los Angeles and fell in love with the ocean when I was about 7 and swam and surfed, got into school at UC Santa Barbara. And I'd been on a couple catamarans, but really not much of a sailor, really a board rider. I saw a lot of boats going out towards the Channel Islands. I wanted to go there. I was so inspired by that connection between the land and an offshore island. And I was talking to a friend of mine. I'm like, look at those boats. He's like, yeah, it's amazing. I'm like, let's go. He's like, what? I don't know anybody who sails. We're 21 years old, went to Santa Barbara Harbor, and came up to like actually what turned out to be the best racing boat in the whole fleet, a boat called Wampum. I said, hi, my name's David and I'm a marine biology student and I really want to learn how to sail. And all these guys kind of looked at me from the deck, and it turned out that this was the most elite racing boat. And the owner looks at me and he's like, sure, come aboard. And his name is Dick Compton, Richard Compton, who's owned several famous racing yachts, Alchemy, which was ultralight, and amazing guy, Geronimo. And so I just said, I will do anything. I'll work on the boat. I just love the ocean so much. But I was also studying chemistry, and he was an organic chemist. So we would talk about all these equations and reactions, and he was fluent with it. So he helped me with my school. And he also helped me financially. And I said, I'll start doing boat bottoms because I'm a diver. So I ended up starting this little company called Neptune Diving Service in Santa Barbara and cleaning eventually only racing bottoms because you just need a diaper instead of a scraper. And Dick Compton, I really owe a lot towards getting me into sailing and then yacht racing. So I joined the sailing team at UC Santa Barbara, sailing FJs. And, you know, I'm not a silver spoon guy. My parents didn't belong to yacht clubs. But I really fell in love with ocean crossings, and that's what really attracted me.
When was your opportunity to first do an ocean crossing, and what was it about it that you fell in love with?
Well, again, it kind of started with, you know, coastal jumps and yacht owners who gave a lot of confidence in a young guy and his friends to do deliveries. So we came up to San Francisco from Santa Barbara to do the big boat series every year. I would come up with the crew and I would deliver the boat back with my friends and go surfing. And I became the navigator and the ad hoc skipper. And again, Mr. Compton, he gave me the confidence, like, you can do it. And I did it. I learned how to navigate and I knew the mathematics. And so I did the coastal stuff. And that's a challenge coming up the coast around Conception.
When are we talking about? Are we talking?
This is 1981, 1982, 1983. Pre-GPS.
Okay.
Yeah, you get a fix every 24 hours or so. My first offshore passage was a transpac. That was Los Angeles to Honolulu. And then I did the delivery back, and I've done several of those.
You knew you had an affinity for the water, but what was it about doing those longer passages that you really fell in love with?
You know, I have dreams of going offshore. And about every decade, I feel this urge, I have to go on a passage that's at least 2 or 3 weeks, and to get deep water under the keel and night after night and the rhythm of the sea and the uncertainty and the planning. It's survival. There's nothing that brings you more close to living than being close to death. And it's dangerous sometimes, no matter how, again, how well you plan it. But it's an adventure, and it's so exciting, and so many unthinkable things unfold, like us pygmy sperm whales, the most endangered species coming around. And you don't tweet it or Facebook it. You experience it because you're living it in the moment. It really is so fulfilling. Early on, the adventures were more about exhilaration, yacht racing, going fast, breaking records like the Top Gun cruise. And then it got to the point where the deliveries were more fun than the races because you could take your time. And as a marine biologist, I could actually look around and understand. And that's when, in the early 80s, we sailed through the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, the gyre. And we saw on the fringes of the high these concentrations of plastic. And that was incredible. It's like, look at all this plastic. And I'd seen ships, you'd sail behind them and see like refrigerators and incredible things dumped out at sea. Maybe that inspired my passion for ocean conservation.
Was there one moment that crystallized for you a need to get into shark conservation?
Right out of college, I worked for a couple of years in Santa Barbara for the environmental department and then went sailing. I had an offer to skipper a boat to Tahiti. We were sailing and through the Tuamotus, first of the Marquesas, then the Tuamotus, diving with sharks. I was the only diver, just experiencing really extreme wildness. So fast forward, coming back, going back to work, I went to graduate school. I'm at UC Berkeley. I had a great job for the biology department, and I was really tired of like going to work every day. And friends of mine from Sausalito, Chris and Holiday Johnson, said like, we want to go to the South Pacific, and I hung out and helped, gave them some advice. It's like, oh, you should get these charts, or you should be careful here. And they're like, well, you should come. Oh, I can't. I'm too busy. Well, at that time, I'd accumulated like 3 or 4 months of vacation, which is a lot when you work for a public university. I hadn't taken any vacation. So it's like, oh, yeah, why? Well, I cannot not go. I have to go. And so I told my boss, I need a semester off. And he said, yeah, great, okay. And so we sailed to the South Pacific, and we saw the longliners, and we dove some of the same areas that I had dove more than a decade before, and there were no sharks. And I saw dead sharks that had been finned. And I didn't understand what was happening at the time. And we were asking some local people, and until we came into the major port of Tahiti, Papeete, and the rail of the ship was lined with shark fins, and we went aboard and hung out, and no shark bodies were coming aboard, and we asked what's happening, and they said, well, we get extra money for the fins, but they don't pay for the shark bodies. And so this is when I learned about the phenomena of shark finning for shark fin soup associated with the increase in Asian wealth. And that was really it. And I came back to work, and I did some research, and I realized this is a global problem that's really untold. And I took another leave of absence and brought a camera, and we really told the story and produced Shark Stewards of the Reef, the first film really about shark finning and ecosystem protection and the importance of sharks to the ocean. And I quit my job, and we produced the film, and I advocated. We founded Shark Stewards and began advocating for protecting sharks and ocean health.
When did you decide that a film was the way to tell the story and to advocate?
Storytelling is so important, and we can all connect to a good story, especially sailors, like telling yarns, right? Or a fisherman. The fish was this big when it was really this big. Visual stories are the best, most compelling stories now. I mean, everybody now is walking around looking into their 3x5 storyteller. Even more importantly now, especially the people who are consuming most of the wildlife in the ocean, which are now is Chinese, because of affluence. This is not a cultural thing. This is all about ability to consume. And we've been lucky enough as Americans to have it for 50 years. Now they have it. But the economy of scale is way beyond. It's exponential. I've always been a photographer from early on, and I love to write, and I've wrote stories and a couple books. And making a film is really a wonderful way to tell a story. And when you make a film underwater, what a gift it was. And I have to credit my friends, the Johnsons, to be like, we got a camera. Like when I went back, it's like, we're not dilettantes. We're not yachts people. We're here for a purpose, or I'm going to go back to work and do what I usually do. And it's like, let's take advantage of what we have, being on this incredible boat in this incredible, inaccessible place, seeing things that nobody else is seeing or saying, documenting it, and sharing it with the world. That's why I'm involved with the Ocean Film Festival. It's like 16 years, you know, we've had thousands of kids that go every year. Like, not everybody can get in the water with sharks like I can, but I want to share that incredible, that experience of being so connected to something so visceral to really what humans are, how close we are to the base of the food chain and as animals ourselves, and yet how consummately adapted and how perfect they are.
Some people hear you say, get in the water with sharks, and say, uh-uh, no way. You, on the other hand, said, this is something we need to protect. What is it about sharks that you find compelling? Tell me about being in the water with sharks and why they're such a special animal.
Before I learned about shark finning and saw sharks getting killed for their fins and saw the mass carnage, essentially, for a luxury, I really wasn't that involved with sharks. When I really learned about the importance of sharks as the apex predator and how they regulate and control the health of the ocean ecosystem. Like the roof of a house, you take the roof off, which is the shark, the walls fall down, and all you have is a concrete floor. So you lose your biodiversity, you lose your complexity. All that trophic complexity really relies on not only the top of the food chain, the apex predators like the big sharks, but also the bottom of the food chain. And many of those cases are the flat sharks that we don't think about, the rays that keep the bottom healthy from eating the dead things or oxygenating the mud so that there's no disease. So it works from bottom up and top down, but it really is not so much for me about the sharks. It's all about the ecosystem. If you see a shark on a reef, that is a healthy reef. If you don't see sharks, you see algae, you see less fish, there's less diversity, there's less abundance.
Tell me about the sharks here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I know we have great whites right off the coast here. How are they doing?
I gave a talk at the St. Francis Yacht Club and talk about sailors, me being one, and how we're thinking about our competitors and lifts and headers and when we should tack or stay out of the current. And we're not thinking 6 inches beneath our keel. The San Francisco Bay is an amazing ecosystem, and it's probably the most complex and important nursery for elasmobranchs, which are sharks, skates, and rays, on the entire west coast of North America. This is like ground zero for sharks. I love it. There are so many species here that Shark Stewards is trying to actually protect habitat for, which is important for herring, Dungeness crab, salmon, halibut, all the things we love to eat, but also what keeps that system regulated. There are many species of sharks in the bay that actually give birth, live birth. They don't lay eggs. The sharks come in, the pregnant females give birth, and some will leave, some live here year round. And occasionally the great white shark will come in underneath the Golden Gate. And we know this with tagging program at Stanford Hopkins Marine Lab that Shark Stewards is affiliated with. And they kind of do this little tour around past here, past the aquatic park, the Dolphin Club, and around the backside of Alcatraz. They don't go too far deep into the bay because of the salinity, and they'll go back out and exit the bay. And we know white sharks come in the bay because the bay is getting healthier, and that's a great sign. We're cleaning up the water. But white sharks are visual predators. They don't really want to be here. It's hard for them to see their prey. Humans aren't their preferred prey. There was the first documented shark predation event at Alcatraz 3 years ago, 2015. Off of Alcatraz, it was caught by a young guy in his phone. He's doing this Jaws theme. And we were planning at the Dolphin Club our Alcatraz swim the week ahead. And everybody's like, should we cancel the swim? I said, you know what? I'll do the test swim because that shark's gone. That's such a rare incident. They're not territorial. They come in and out. And that was a really lucky shark to get a sea lion and the visibility of the bay, which is very poor.
So we're doing this interview not long after you've just gotten out of the water. Is it something that crosses your mind when you swim in the bay?
I'm just finishing a book on sharks, skates, and rays of San Francisco Bay and our National Marine Sanctuaries. And it kind of starts with that, how we're in the water and you ever get that feeling that there might be a shark. And I think there's an inherent sense of survival that we have because humans were kind of fish. We came out and we never went back, whereas whales and pinnipeds did. So we don't have that instinct anymore. And so we're afraid because we are not adapted. We're out there flailing. I swim at night all the time, and I'm not afraid of getting bit by a shark. I'd be more concerned about a boat hitting me here in the bay. But many people think irrationally of sharks because of films like Jaws or Shark Attack Week and that fear factor. But it's so rare that humans get bit by sharks. I mean, 5 deaths globally a year, whereas crossing the streets, hundreds of thousands probably globally a year, and all the other relative risks are so much higher. So I think about it and I hope to see them. And actually, we do see them because we dive here.
Tell me about diving with sharks. What's the experience like?
Diving with sharks, to me, is so visceral. It's so exciting when you can really like get beyond that. Oh my God, is it going to bite me? You take a breath, you meditate, you look at this animal, and they look at you, and you realize, like, this is wildness. This is something perfect about hundreds of millions of years of evolution in the ocean. These animals have survived 5 great extinctions, and they're on their 6th, which is created by man. And they deserve to survive because they've earned it. They've survived the last great extinction with the dinosaurs. They are the living dinosaurs. They are so perfect and so essential for the health of our current ecosystem that we should really respect them and try to coexist with them. I encourage people who are confident to get into the water with sharks if it's done properly. There's a lot of people who are adrenaline seekers. You really need to respect nature. You don't want to ride a shark any more than you want to touch a grizzly bear. But if you can see a shark in its wild element, not in a zoo, not on YouTube, you should consider yourself blessed.
I'm hearing a parallel between that experience of getting to see a shark in its natural habitat and what you experience when you're offshore, that feeling of being out there.
There is something elemental in humanity that we're hanging on to about being connected to nature, and it's harder and harder. I mean, here we are in San Francisco. We're like right next to like these huge brains coding and ones and zeros and doing their electronic, whatever people do, right? It's like, and doing great things that I use all these products or a lot of them, right? But when you're away from that, when you don't have your cell phone and you have the stars and the waves, that's what our ancestors had. And you have this sense of everyday consciousness and presentness. And that's what going offshore is. It's getting away from all of that static bombarding us. And you're really like, there's a front coming, or I can feel the pressure change in my ear and there's probably a storm. Or look at that incredible animal that just breached the surface. What could that be? And it's the same as getting underwater. And it's like, holy shit, look at that shark. That thing could turn around and bite me in a second. And yet it has no interest because it's looked at me, scanned me, and recognizes that I'm not its prey. But looking a white shark in the eye is something that you will never forget. I have to say that.
When is the first time that that happened? You must remember that moment.
I'm glad you asked that because writing the book has brought back a lot of my memories because I've had to go back to sailing logs. And I mean, the first time I saw a shark, I was like, I think I was 10 and I was at Malibu and it was during Jaws and everybody was freaked out. And it was great because nobody was surfing and there was a splash at the surface and a fin. This guy next to me freaked out, shark. I'm like, what? And it turns out it was a leopard shark. You know, it was like a 6-inch fin. And I was fascinated. But the first time I saw a white shark was sailing from a delivery from the Big Boat series on a Nelson Merrick 41 called Quintessence. And we were at right off Pebble Beach, a pretty famous surf break that I won't name, kind of a sharky spot. And my friend Bob and I anchored the boat and we were ready to paddle in. And he's like, "Dave, what's that?" And I looked over the side, and there's this big gray shape that rolled and turned blindingly white, and this big black eye. As a biologist, it's like, okay, what's white? Pygmy sperm whales? No, it's not Moby Dick. Arctic seals? No, we're not. Arctic polar bears? Nope. There's nothing white around here but a white shark. And it's like, holy, he's like, that's a fucking great white shark. Holy shit, we step back from it. It's like, it seemed like half the length of the 41-foot boat. And it's the girth. I mean, with white sharks, it's not the length. That's the girth, man. It was like 7 feet across. We're like, oh, wow. So we up anchored and surfed elsewhere. And then later on, diving off of Santa Barbara as an undergraduate, I dove San Miguel. And I thought I was an orca, actually. And we were diving for abalone. And this shark came out of the, like, you know, indecipherable blue, green, I should say. And there's this huge looming shape. And it's like, whoa, because there'd been orcas. And yet there's no telltale white patches. And it's, no, it was a great white shark. And my buddy's got his head under this ledge. And I kind of grab his fin. He's like, what are you doing? It's like, we better go up. But it was a really big shark. And it didn't come back around. But when you see that, there's something like atavistic, it dates back to different generations where we have what we surfers call sharkiness. When you're in the water, you get the sixth sense. It's like, I feel uneasy, like this feels dangerous. This is going back to our reptile brain, right? Our big mammal brain, all the thinking and the cerebral cortex, that gets turned off in nature, and you've got your lizard brain working, and that's all your sensory network. And the surfers call it sharkiness, and you sense something dangerous. And in this case, I kind of felt uneasy. And then there's this giant shadow, and it was the great white grin.
What can somebody who wants to help sharks, what can they do?
I believe if we care about the health of the ocean, or even the health of the future of humanity, we need to think about an overall consciousness of how we act. And we can do that if we live 1,000 miles from the ocean. Just minimizing plastic pollution is a huge issue in the ocean and human health. Our consumption patterns, east and west, are eating up the world, which is impacting the ocean. And we're looking at the ocean as this giant refrigerator and a giant sewage pit. So we're putting way too much shit in, and we're taking way too many living things out. So if we eat a fish, we should consider, you know, like, what is this fish? This is amazing. If you've ever seen a yellowfin tuna, they are incredible as a shark. Super fast, super adapted, amazing animals. We should eat that with reverence and eat it rarely. So thinking about our food consumption, our consumption patterns, I mean, you know, we know this, right? We hear about it, especially here in the West, recycling, reusable containers, straws. That's a new thing, plastic straws. One of the things, certainly, we don't need shark fin soup. Shark fin soup is a luxury, whether it be Chinese-American, Chinese-Canadian, Chinese-Western European, or Chinese-Chinese. It's a luxury. It's associated with wealth and honor and face. But none of those attributes are considering the future of the ocean. We need to think about how we're using the whole ecosystem and a consciousness and an intactness. And if we want to do that as a race, we need to think about the integrity of the ocean. And that starts at the top with the apex predators. We love whales. We love dolphins, but we're killing whales and dolphins. We've overhunted many of those, but those species, we've also protected them because we love them. We realize it's wrong. And sharks, we are down at the bottom. We really don't care because of all these misconceptions of Jaws or shark attacks, when really they're probably iconically the most important fish in the ocean. So by not eating shark fin soup, not eating big sharks at all, unless it's like really, really by need, that's going to help the whole ocean. And then helping nonprofits like sharkstewards.org, where we have an education advocacy, we work internationally, we need international support, but also we work locally with youth, trying to educate kids in the water, on the water, getting connected to the ocean. We all need to know the ocean is our source of oxygen, our food, our climate, our balance, our recreation, our adventure. It's still our Everest. It's still incredibly adventurous to go out and sail across it. And that's what connects us all on this planet as humans.
I think that's a perfect place to stop. I really want to thank you for taking the time and telling us a little bit about what's beneath the keel.
Even when you scrape the barnacles off, respect those barnacles. They need a place to live.
But they do slow us down.
Definitely. Actually, wipe it with a diaper before they colonize.
There you go. Thanks, David.
As you can tell, David's truly passionate about what he does. You can find out more about David's work and Shark Stewards by visiting sharkstewards.org. And you can find David's first film, one he mentioned when we were talking, Shark Stewards of the Reef, on Amazon Prime. Check it out. Thanks for listening to Out the Gate, the podcast about sailing and adventure on and around San Francisco Bay. Until next time, I'm Ben Shaw, your host and producer.